Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Get your Louisville Slugger Detroit Tigers World Series bats limited edition for only $129.95 for a limited time only. Call 1-866-490-BATS or visit BigTimeBats.com. 1-866-480-BATS or BigTimeBats.com.
Here's a question. What are you worth? I mean, what are you worth in the job market? What skills and knowledge do you possess that create value for a company? Do you have what it takes for employers to pay you $65,000 a year on average? Do you have what it takes to start right out of school making $30,000 or $40,000 a year? Have you positioned yourself in the fastest growing industry rated by the United States federal government? Good questions. Tough answers. If you're stuck making less than $45,000 a year with no way to increase your income, it's time to visit computertraining.com. Log on to their website at www.computertraining.com. And find out why their graduates are living their dreams by making an investment in themselves for a better tomorrow today. Please note up front that not everyone is qualified. You'll need to demonstrate that you have solid computer skills and a sincere desire to succeed in order to be accepted into their new Microsoft XP program. To learn more, visit www.computertraining.com and take the online entrance challenge. Again, that's computertraining.com, helping you build a better tomorrow today. Computertraining.com does not guarantee job placement or job salary levels. Pay scales can be dramatically affected by employer size, industry, employee credentials, years of experience, and other factors.
Hey, Screwy Louis! Gurus and guys all know the fun people are at Screwy Louis in South Lyon. Don't miss the Wicked Halloween Party, Saturday, October 28th. Get in the costume contest for great prizes, a live DJ spinning your favorite music. And don't forget about Power Hour every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday with dollar drinks from 11 to midnight. The Wicked Halloween Party, Saturday, October 28th. Screwy Louis in South Lyon on Lake Street at Lafayette. Don't be caught dead anywhere.
Hello? Is this where I go to get a recording contract?
Well, this is a music label, but you're a...
Cheesy Gordita Crunch from Taco Bell. But I want to be a rapper.
You want to be a rapper?
Yeah, call me Cheesy G.
Okay.
I'm warm flatbread covered in 3 melted cheeses wrapped around a crunchy taco and topped with a zesty pepper jack sauce. I'm crunchy, chewy, and cheesy.
What does being crunchy, chewy, and cheesy have to do with rap?
A lecture on texture.
Okay.
I'm chewy and gooey. I'm cheesy and easy.
Taco Bell's Cheesy Gordita Crunch. Warm flatbread covered in 3 melted cheeses. Wrapped around a crunchy taco and topped with a zesty pepper jack sauce. To get crunchy, chewy, and cheesy, think outside the bun. At participating locations for a limited time. Got a taste for something crunchy, spicy, melty, or grilled? Then head to Taco Bell and experience Fourth Meal. The late night meal between dinner and breakfast. For exciting late night taste, think outside the bun. Taco Bell is open till 2 a.m. or later. Hours may vary by location.
An important message for motorists.
Gas is killing me.
You've suffered long enough.
Really hurts when I fill up.
Relief is on the way.
Gas, you can pay a high price. Or just grab a Rolaids Plus Soft Chew and feel better.
Rolaids Plus stops gas with the most effective anti-gas medicine available. Tums can't. Chewy, not chalky, Rolaids Plus stops heartburn and the pain and bloating of gas.
Who can afford gas? Use Rolaids Plus Gas Relief.
Use it directed.
Broken Tales.
Agamemnon.
Speak.
Tell me the ways of the warrior.
The hardened warrior lives a life of defense.
But what should one do when loins are aflame?
Then I employ an ultra-thin sheath of sensitivity granted to me by a Trojan man.
You must have women flying like turtle doves, waiting for you to covet their kingdom.
Yeah, I do okay.
Trojan Man Ultra Thin, our thinnest latex condom ever. Pleasure you want, protection you trust.
Everybody knows dogs can hear things people can't. But did you know that with HD Radio, you can hear things other people can't? An enormous variety of new music, news, sports, and talk shows on hidden HD radio stations. And with Boston Acoustics Receptor Radio HD, you can enhance your enjoyment by unleashing all the potential of HD radio with unequaled digital clarity. HD Radio. Discover it at bostonacoustics.com.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to rock out all this weekend with the Riff. All this weekend, listen to 101 WRIF and score your copy of Mission Impossible 3. Rated PG on DVD, available in stores October 30th. Plus, everyone who wins will also score a special agent gadget. It could be an iPod, a digital camera, a prepaid Motorola cell phone, an iRiver MP3 player, a set of Bose headphones, or a JVC MP3 docking station. This message will not self-destruct in 5 seconds. However, we will add a completely superfluous explosion sound effect because you're expecting it. There you go. You're welcome. The Riffs MI3 Weekend. Listen and win from 101 WRIF.
Everything rocks.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riffs phone and talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome to the program. Night Call brought to you this hour by Waking Up. Metro Detroit's Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile and DeQuinder in Warren. You can go to wakingupstore.com. And Mike and Denise Kitchen, who are the proprietors, asked me to remind you that tomorrow, October 30th through Sunday, November 5th, everything in the Waking Up store is going to be 20% off. For union members, the discount is 25% off. They're big supporters of unions and unionization. Now, I love these folks and their sponsors. The only thing, I know they're listening as well. So it's sort of an odd formulation. Because one of the things we know about unionization and people that belong to unions, they get better wages and better benefits than people that don't. So it almost ought to be the other way around. Now, it's their store, and I'll read this as it is, and I know they mean only the best by both union members and non-union members, just working people in general, particularly people that are waking up and going to their store in the Universal Mall. But I would do it the other way around. Because as a union member myself and someone who's been a union member for a long time of the Broadcasters Union, we make better wages than people that ain't. So whatever, just a little comment. Well, and I'm sort of stalling. I mean, not that this wasn't important, but hey, by the way, our numbers are 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. As usual, we are open line. Anything you'd like to talk about, I am open to talk about as well. Within reason, sometimes even outside of reason. And if you'd like to email me, call talkyes@yahoo.com. This program is international via the internet. What is ZZ Top sings, I'm bad, I'm nationwide. Well, we go across the country and across the world, but primarily we're located in Detroit, Michigan. And we broadcast into southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, and northern Ohio. But hey, everybody's welcome. Y'all come. And something just, oh yeah. I've been in New York City all week, so I didn't get a chance to put this up on my website, but a couple of very interesting interviews in a couple of hours at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Please do the math for your region of the world. And one will be a biography of Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary was the LSD guru of the 60s and into the 70s. An amazing career and life. Prison breaks, LSD experiments with people like Cary Grant, and just a story worth telling, to be sure. And also, we'll have an interview with Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn is probably the nation's most eminent historian. He'll be here on November 5th, this coming Sunday. And so an interview with him to start things as well.
This is Mike from, I don't know whether Mike wants the, if the, Al is answering the phones at 313-298-WRIF. I see Mike is the first caller, and we always don't get, sometimes this little screen thing we have, we don't get the communications between the rooms here. But if this is this Mike from, or is this, no, it's not Mike from the Waking Up Store. All right, it's another Mike. As we speak, well, let me start this in another way. Tragedy is always present in this world. In many ways, tragedy is part of life. People are born, people die. It's always a tragedy. When people pass away, our relatives, our friends, sometimes it's particularly tragic because it's people we don't expect through accident or illness or something like that. And the closer to home a tragedy is, the more that affects us. The more that the people are like us, their misfortune or their death hits us more. It's almost by definition, no matter how much we try. Even those of us, now the vast majority of American people, that know that Bush's cruel and criminal war in Iraq and the invasion and occupation based on lies has done nothing except destroy that country, when we learn that there are 600,000 deaths because of Bush's war and a million people that have been pushed into refugee status, what hits us, most of us, is the 2,800-plus Americans that have died, the 20,000 severely wounded Americans, and have become in the total number. I think I've said before, when I put the number, when I update the number each week, or sometimes when there's big battles and great American loss of life, and, of course, we're very meticulous about that. We know exactly how many Americans have been killed and how many have been wounded. And yet there's an argument about how many Iraqis have been killed by United States troops. Is it 600,000? Is it only 100,000 or whatever? But we take great care to document how many of our fellow citizens have died in this fool's war, fool being Bush, of course. But that's an aggregate number. Most of us can ignore it. I mean, as I said, spent the week in New York, didn't spend a lot of time thinking about all of this. I had family there, friends, went to performances, ate wonderful food. That's what occupied us. And a lot of us, I don't know what percentage, have enough diversions. And when I say tragedy, I'm not talking about the way the Tigers played ball to lose the World Series. But we have, if we're lucky, and then most of us are, I think, at least have some portion of our life that's in balance, that we have family or friends or occupations or hobbies that make life worth living. But when a tragedy strikes, when a loss happens to someone very close to us, it becomes even more significant. And of course, just by definition, where am I going with this? Well, as we speak, the Mexican police and army are destroying the Oaxaca commune. Oaxaca is O-A-X-A-C-A. Am I right? Is that a Mayan name, probably? It looks like maybe it looks like Oaxaca. It does to me. But there has been a standoff between protesting teachers' union members and their supporters in the usually resort town of Oaxaca. Very beautiful city. I know my dad and his wife were there last year. But it's been occupied by a force of ordinary people against the corrupt rule of this party that's called the PRI, this, what was it called, Institutional Revolutionary Party, and has been ruling for about 70 years. Of course, now they've been kicked out of national office and what have you, but it's known as the PRI, and it's filled with gangsters and thugs, and people settle a lot of political arguments there by force of arms. But the teachers set up an occupation of the Oaxaca, the town square, and were joined by thousands of other people, and there's been pretty much of a standoff. They're demanding that the corrupt governor, who they say, much like people in our country, was elected only through fraud. And finally, there was, and a lot of what happens from the people on the right is they employ pistoleros, the assassins, thugs, gangsters, to take out their violence, much like in Colombia as well, on union members, progressive people, leftists, anybody that's not submitting to the dominant right-wing state of affairs, right? So, when must have this have been? Was it Saturday or Friday? This group of off-duty police attacked one of the barricades that are set up there, shot several Mexican members that were there, and also killed a young man from New York City named Brad Will from Indie Media. Indie Media. If I can go to indymedia.org, I-N-D-Y. IndieMedia.org. Yeah, I was thinking, we've talked about this too. I was watching CNN tonight, and I'm thinking, what a waste. I mean, this is supposed to be, what do the right-wingers call it? You know, communist something radio, communist network news. And I'm thinking, this is barely makes it to the center. And if you're going to watch a screen, why bother with CNN or Fox or even MSNBC, except maybe when, what's his name? I can't even think of what his name is. That commentator that's really letting Bush have it. Don't bother to send me the name. And yet, if you're going to sit in front of a screen, go to indymedia.org, I-N-D-Y-media.org. Go to narconews.org if you want to see what's going on right now. Because in Oaxaca, as we speak, federal police, armed with assault rifles and riot shields, stormed this normally picturesque tourist destination Sunday, bypassing barricades, touching off fierce street battles as they tried to end 5 months of protests. Officers in black helmets entered the city from several sides, reinforced by armored vehicles, trucks mounted with high-pressure water cannons and bulldozers. Helicopters roared overhead. And let's see here. Just federal police backed by armored vehicles and water cannons tore down barricades, stormed and battled Oaxaca on Sunday, taking control of the city center, which was held by protesters for 5 months. A human rights worker said a 15-year-old protester was killed in the offensive launched earlier in the day. Brad Will, says here, was undeterred by violence. In fact, I'd like to dedicate the program to him. And that's what I'm talking about, it close to you. There has been these right-wing death squad groups. These pistoleros, off-duty cops, have killed probably 10 Mexicans since April. But I'm focusing on the American. And one of the reasons I am, because when I was in New York City, this young man, Brad Will, was a friend of several of the people that I knew as well. And there was a vigil Friday night at the Mexican consulate in New York City. And tomorrow there's another demonstration I think as early as 9 a.m. in New York City, if you're there. But Brad Will was undeterred by violence, felt compelled to document what he called human rights abuses around the globe, so he headed to the volatile city of Oaxaca in Mexico. As the situation turned increasingly dangerous, Will decided to stay, despite his fears. He wanted people to know what was happening in Oaxaca. He says, he wrote to an email to a friend, "Life is crazy. I'm entering a new territory here, and I don't know if I am ready." The 36-year-old videographer from New York was killed Friday in the Mexican city where protesters have barricaded streets. The gunfire erupted in a rough neighborhood when armed men, probably police, tried to remove a barricade set up by protesters. Tony Garza, who was a Bush-appointed U.S. ambassador, said that it appears that Mr. Will was killed during a shootout between what may have been the local police. So here was a man who wasn't going there on assignment as part of his occupation. And as a journalist, I don't put those people in a lower category when they're shot and killed in Iraq or wherever else than Brad Will, who went there willingly, not because partly he would sell footage and sell stories, but one has to maintain oneself. But mostly he was there out of an ethical concern to stop the many tragedies that that we face around the world that we see continually. He said, "I will intervene in this at the risk of my own life," and he gave it. So as I said, I'll dedicate this program to him. If you'd like to read more about this, you can actually just go right now to news.yahoo.com and or go to my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, because that has the links to indymedia.org and narconews.com. All right, lots more to talk about, but let's see what you'd like to talk about. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Emails to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Here is Mike. Mike's our first caller in Westland. Mike, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Yeah, Peter, you know, I just wanted to say I really like your show. I listen to it. I work the afternoon shift for a steel company, and I'm a union member, and I come from a long line of union members. And some of the people at work that are union members like to say, you know, are like big Bush supporters. And I just, with their train of thought and what I've been, because I talk about your show at work and they, you know, a lot of the people don't listen to it. So they're just ignorant to what you talk about. But I think a lot of people out there, like you said, your wage is better because you're a union member. But not only is the wages better for non-union workers, because they have to compete against the union sector and they can't get the quality people or right. keep them because they go union. But even when they had slave shops and sweatshops back in the early days, every piece of safety equipment in a new building comes from the union movement. Push doors so people can get out in case of fires, that came because non-union employees who turned union wanted a safer working environment. Egress lighting in hallways and stairways was produced by the union movement.
Sure.
The whole entire sprinkler system in new buildings was progressed because of fires that killed people that were chained to sewing machines back in the day. And I think a lot of these people, they don't realize that it's. I would not be surprised if it gets bad, not like it was back then, but it'll get a lot worse as the union membership drops down because of abuses and the foot and neck method that the non-union is trying to bring to even all the union sector.
Well, I got to tell you can tell the guys at work I said that if you're a union member and support any Republican or particularly Bush, you've got to be a first magnitude moron. It's like you're...
it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
I look at them and I think, how ignorant can you be to think like that?
Well, they're probably off on one of the wedge issues. They're probably concerned about gay marriage or guns or whatever the hell else they are, you know, something like that.
Well, in regards to that, you know, I'm not gay. I'm married. If you're gay, great. You know, I don't think that's anybody's business.
Right.
And I don't think the government should tell somebody how they should lead their life. I just, you know, I'm not gay. I'm not going to be converted. It doesn't make any difference to me if someone's gay. I think that they should mind their own business. And as far as abortion goes, I'm not ever going to be forced into that position to have to live with that decision. So I think that they should not force people to keep them from doing something that they have to live with in their own mind.
Well, here we're in perilous economic terms for anybody except for the wealthy and the big upscale people. People in industrial unions, particularly like steel workers, are really in the gun sights of these conservatives who want to blow away the last vestige of protection and decent wage structure for the working class. And if these people, no matter what their motivation is, going to support those people that are trying to destroy the apparatus, as you very eloquently said, Mike, have brought us wage standards and working standards and vacations and all of that, all of which is beginning to erode, by the way. These are people that are cutting their own throats and the throats of their family. And they're a sandwich short of a picnic, I'll tell you. Mike, I got to go. Thank you so much for all that. You're absolutely right. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And we've got a little thing here where the phones don't disconnect. Oh, well, what the hell. Here's Mike. Mike's in Birmingham. Hi, Mike. Peter Werbe here on the air.
Hi. How you doing, Peter?
Doing well. Thanks.
I'd like to comment on Rush Limbaugh's comments about Michael J. Fox on the television Did you hear about that?
Well, I did read about it, but you know what I'm looking forward to? When Rush Limbaugh start, when people call Rush Limbaugh and say, did you hear what Peter Werby said the other night? I mean,
no.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing him a massive favor. I mean, the guy, I mean, everybody in radio, including me, yeah, has a sense of what, you know, how can you bring attention to yourself? I mean, I don't do much of it. I don't get much attention other than this broadcast. But it's like he knows that he can make outrageous comments. There's another. There's a, and I won't mention her name ever. What do I? I was doing some work on that national network, Air America, and I was calling her DHB, Despicable Human Being. It's this tall, thin woman with blonde hair. Who thinks up the most outrageous statements to make, like insulting 9/11 unions. I just saw it. Widows, 9/11 widows, and everybody gets absolutely outraged, goes nuts, and everyone knows her name. Then, you know, I mean, few of you don't. So, but I'm not going to give her any free publicity.
Yeah, it was supposedly Rush Limbaugh made insensitive remarks about, see, Michael J. Fox appeared on television, made an ad about, it's something to do with the stem cell research, like allowing stem cell research, and he made these insensitive comments, and he was commenting about how Michael J. Fox was, like, you know, twisting and turning on the TV set because he's got Parkinson's, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, well, then apparently
supposedly he made his insensitive remarks saying, oh, he was just faking these movements, you know, making himself look appear as though
He did then apologize, but I don't think, as usual, it wasn't a very heartfelt apology. As I've said before, all of these right-wing talk show hosts make extraordinary errors in facts. They're continually saying things that just aren't true. I mean, it's one thing to have an opinion. I mean, that's sort of a combination of a fact and an opinion. But they never clean up after themselves. They're part of the big lie. It's, I mean, typical of the right wing is to just say whatever they want, and then they have these slavish listeners, these morons who call themselves ditto heads. I mean, I can't imagine any lower category than being a ditto head for anybody. You know how many, I've been doing this a long time. You know how many ditto heads I have? Zero. Absolute zero. You know how many I want? The exact number that I have. And that's the way it should be. Free human beings are not ditto heads for some radio broadcaster or for some politician. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I don't want you to think that we're only doing mics tonight, but here's Mike from Fraser. Mike, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good.
I just tuned in, and I heard the caller before this one. Talking about unions, kind of got in the middle of that call, and it sort of immediately got my hackles up because I want to correct you on something. You said that just now our standard of living and, you know, benefits and so on, all the benefits of the labor movement are eroding. This shot was fired across organized labor file back in 1981, I mean.
Sure.
With Patco and Reagan, he was their front man that started this whole thing. Now, let me just give you my background. I'm a systems guy. I'm a computer programmer, and so I've never been in a union in my entire life. But my father was a union. He was a skilled tradesman at Chrysler, and so I've always felt like my bread was buttered by organized labor for many years, and. So the thing is, in the IT world, for many years, all the people I worked with were all sort of anti-labor.
Mm-hmm.
They all felt they got where they got, you know, by their brains and their all this nonsense. And I was telling these guys 20 years ago, you're wrong. And look what's happened. Now,
sure.
Now IT people are outsourced, laid off. You know, all kinds of stuff going on. It's basically the steel workers all over again.
It is indeed. And you're absolutely right about the history of it. I didn't mean to say that this is something that all of a sudden had appeared with the election of George W. Bush. This is a long-standing right-wing conservative agenda to roll back essentially the Roosevelt era reforms where that after years and years of struggles that finally people got a chance to organize and drive up the condition of their labor, both in terms of what it meant, you know, safety stuff like the other Mike was mentioning, and certainly wages and benefits. Now, it's all going the other way, and whereas we see a stock market that goes above 12,000, and this is what Bush calls a good economy, on the other hand, that wages and benefits are beginning to shrink. So you know, what sense does this make? Well, it's a process that I think can easily be labeled as looting, is that as our productivity as workers grow, that we don't share in this, but rather it only goes to the owners. So this is back to the 19th century. This is not a good state of affairs. All right, Mike, speaking of owners, I got to do some little bit of business here. Let me. I don't know whether you're going to disconnect or not. No, I don't know what the hell is going on here. Good. That's the only way I can do it, I guess. But actually, I did want. Here's how this all started about unions. Our sponsor, the Waking Up Store at the Universal Mall in Warren, is having a sale. Actually, it is. Where did I see this? In his, he says, "Oh yeah, it's a get a jump on the holidays sale." So they're giving 20% off at the Waking Up Store in the mall, at the Universal Mall. Next week, 20%, and for union members, the discount is 25%. And I said, given the fact that us union members get better wages than other people in our industry and better benefits, it ought to be the other way around. So I'm just reading this, Mike, with, I hope this is okay. It says, hi, Peter, you're right. I'm listening. I actually had considered what you suggested because of the wage differential between union employees and non-union and gave it some serious thought about reversing the discounts. The reason I went the way we did was because of things I've heard from union members who have shopped at our stores. Many have stated how many of their members shop at the big box, the Walmarts and whatnot, because it's cheaper for them. So I'm using it as a carrot for our loyal union customers to use on their brothers and sisters to encourage them to check out our store. Okay. I mean, like I said, that's a legitimate way to do it. And I certainly wasn't being critical. And I mean, there's so few stores. Imagine that. I mean, I think I said this the first time that Mike and Denise Kitchen advertised with WRIF, and particularly this show, that's Metro Detroit Sweatshop Pre Clothing Store. And of course, our Sweatshop Pre Union Made hats are off to Mike and Denise, but why is this a specialty store? It means because you go to every other damn store in that mall and every other store around, and they're not sweatshop free. That our stuff is being made in other countries by almost slave labor. All right, quick break, and we'll be back. 313-298-WRIF. In fact, let me see here. Where is this here? Are we going to start with an ad for it? I think so.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
This is WRIM.com.
We'll be right back.
What did you expect to find? Was it something you left behind? Don't you remember anything I said when I said, jump away, leave me to myself, jump away.
With more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to another segment. Your calls are welcome. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We're open line. We're talking somewhat about unions, but and also the fact the Mexican army has destroyed the Oaxaca commune. It's in Oaxaca, in Mexico, normally a tourist attraction. When I call it a commune, if some of you, probably only a fraction of you, have ever heard of the Paris Commune in the 19th century, but there's, it's very comparable. Might be worth a Google. I was coming to work today and noticed the price of gas is beginning to kind of go up a bit, eh? How about around your place? $2.21 at Citgo, the only place I ever buy gasoline, because Exxon Mobil, who remember last quarter had this record of all time for all corporations, $10,710,000,000, and of course prices are down just a little bit, so they only made $10,500,000,000 in the third quarter. I don't know what they're going to do. Although, how about this? According to Howard Silverblatt, you know Howard. He's the Standard & Poor's Senior Index Analyst, whatever the hell that is. He says that the company may beat that next quarter. Then, in all likelihood, they will be in the $40 billion mark for the year. That's the profit, $40 billion. So, how do you make money under capitalism? It's called profit, right? The difference between what your costs and what you can sell stuff for. And the fact that their profits keep going up, this is another example of looting. Because if their prices went up and they had to sell it for more, their profits would remain the same. But they're obviously gouging us. So, and the gouging is starting to go up again because, you know, they didn't want to go into the election with gasoline over $3 a gallon, and then it went down 1 point, even went below $2, so $1.99 around here. Oh, yeah, let me just get back a little. So you if you're buying, like, ExxonMobil, you are contributing to this swollen profit. If you buy at Citgo, it's all going to help every poor people, particularly in Venezuela, which the government of Venezuela owns the company there. I mean, I don't like paying a lot for gas, even if it's going there, but, you know, I don't feel so badly. In fact, in a way, there is a slight manner in which I don't mind at all. If you are someone whose wages and standard of living is under attack, and in order to drive to work and you've bought like an SUV or something like that, and you're getting terrible mileage, well, you know, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, man, I would rather this poor person or this working person had the money rather than sending it to a poor person or a working person, you know, in Venezuela. Of course, as been noted on this program a number of times, Citgo also helps people in this country with poor people in this country with cheap heating fuel oil and the rest. But in any event, as some, this is not a big a burden on me as it is on other people. So it bites me in the butt big time, mega big time, in order to to have to if I ever had. Can't buy at Citgo, because I know, and I forgot who else, some other companies weighed in with big record profits as well. It's just going to ultra-rich people, the stockholders, CEOs that are making tens of millions or hundreds of millions, where if it's going to Citgo, at least it's going to the poor. Anyway, here's what Naomi Prinz, who's the author of the piece, How the Republicans Can Manipulate Oil Prices for Political Gain. Now, gas prices have fallen from an average of $3.04 a gallon to $2.25 per gallon. So I guess the fact that it's at $2.21. And, hey, how about this? If you can beat that, if you can beat that by a lot in your area of this town, Detroit, or around the country, give me a call and let me know. 313-298-WRIF. In other words, 221 here. What are you looking at that's a lot lower? And if it's a lot higher, let me know as well, because I think it's on the way up, because they're getting antsy. Because the worst we were going to do to them, them being the Republicans, was vote them out of office. They're buddies. You know, they're all oilmen. They're all involved in this racket to fleece us. And we don't do too much. We started getting a little PO'd when it got around $3, and we see people at the gas pump. We say, oh, man, this really sucks. You know, I mean, that's about it. They can live with that. But let's see, in a September USA poll, USA Today poll, 42% of Americans thought there was a direct connection between the Republicans wanting to keep control of Congress and gas prices falling. So why am I laughing? I am laughing is, what does that mean? 58% of people didn't think there was a connection? I mean, that goes back to the Mark Twain quote that I'm so fond of, right? Which is, consider the intelligence of the average American man and then realize 50% are even dumber. I mean, how could this be? Oh, it's market forces, right? Well, let's see. In fact, Tony Snow, that slimeball White House spokesperson for Bush, he's answered to Steve, essentially by Steve Kretzmann, executive director of Oil Change International. I wonder what that is. Executive Director of Oil Change International, Kretzmann's most recent piece is Separation of Oil and State. Now, you've all heard separation of church and state, but this is interesting, separation of oil and state. He said today, what we're seeing in the oil markets right now is a chilling demonstration of the mutual and constantly converging interests of oil and state in the U.S., the constantly converging interests of oil and state in the U.S. In other words, he says, it's not a conspiracy. It's the gasoline market, which is an oligopoly. How come I can't say that word? An oligopoly. That's what it is. An oligopoly, which means an oligopoly is just a few sellers. So it's like a monopoly, except instead of one, there's, one. This is oli, is the prefix. So it means there's a lot, an oligopoly. Recognizing that its collective self-interest lies in more Republican rule. Because they can get along okay with the Dems, but they know that the Republicans are just going to give them the store. As Kretzmann says, in the current election cycles, the Center for Responsive Politics reports that donations from the oil industry and its employees are running 83% in favor of Republicans. 17%, hedges their bets. This is the most pronounced slant by the oil industry and possibly the most pronounced in any industry ever. Clearly, they know which side their bread is buttered on and can take actions to protect those interests. Now, there's only one other way that you could look at this. I mean, people used to say I was really a nice guy to people, but I'm just leaving that so far behind. You got to be a moron to think that these oil companies are supporting the Republicans because they have an interest in good government. they think our land will be administered more efficiently, effectively, and fairly if the Republicans come in. They know that this government has turned into 100% of a racket for the wealthy, them. And it's being run by the wealthy. Oil racketeers themselves, Bush and Cheney. And let's not forget Condoleezza Rice, who had an oil ship, an oil tanker named after her, which they, you know, they took that away. That looks a little weird, doesn't it? All right. I want to get to the oil prices. 313-298-WRIF. But here, Adam's been waiting a long time with this one. Adam, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Quite a while since I listened to you, because I haven't been up this late in quite a while. But I'm obviously voting next week, and I haven't heard a whole lot of discussion anywhere about this proposal too, you know, the affirmative action thing with the colleges. I've heard a lot about that, and I could tell you as a union member, I'm going to be, if all I know is that I'm voting yes for equal treatment for kids getting into like U of M. If that's all it's about, then I'm going to be voting yes. But I know there's some other parts of this proposal, too, that I don't know a whole lot about.
Well, it has a broad effect. I mean, for one thing, it's this, again, it's part of this right-wing agenda that was initiated by these conservatives from California. I mean, God, don't they have enough problems there? Isn't it?
Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, affirmative action, it does have, in a way, the effect of, you know, having the sense, like, shouldn't we all have just equal access to things? But as you probably know, Adam, that 30 years ago, that most everything from universities to television, radio, wherever, was pretty much an white male deal.
Okay.
And the only reason that any of that changed is because there was a political social decision to say, let's make everything in this society look a little closer to everyone who are citizens. So it's done a pretty good job so far. But people of color, women, people with disabilities, things like that, they used to get the real short end of the stick. And every once in a while, someone who is a white male, like you and me, gets passed over in a manner that says, wait a minute, what did I do? You know, why don't I have an equal shot at this? Why is someone else getting a better shot at this just because of their gender or their color or their ethnic origin or the shape or the condition of their body? And it's pretty hard to take. So, I mean, what we're looking for, essentially, is a society in which nobody gets screwed. And that's not the way it's been historically. And the affirmative action is brought that a little closer to that goal. Not to say that there hasn't been problems with it. But there's people chomping at the bit want to talk more about these gas prices. I'm glad you brought this up. Let me turn it over to more people. I'll tell you why I'm laughing. All right, so thank you for that. Here is Pat in Flint. Is this, Pat, you say your cell phone is dying?
Oh, well, it was getting close. I didn't know how long I'd have. So.
I just wonder, is this just kind of a ruse to jump ahead of the line? But go ahead.
No, not at all. I didn't think you'd get to me that quick. I was just letting them know in case I wasn't there when you came on.
What's happening, Pat?
Not much. I just heard what you were saying about the gas prices, and you was wanting to know there was anything, you know, cheaper around the area or more, like I said, I'm from the plant. But there's the majority of the stations around here are around the 220 mark, but there's a couple in the Flint area that are 208.
Really?
Yeah, and I think that's weird, you know, in the same town, how you can just drive a mile down the road and save 20 cents on gas.
It's actually, it's starting to creep up again, though, isn't it?
Right, yeah, like a couple weeks ago, it was down to, I seen it 198, you know, a couple times.
What's your sense of thing? Do you think it's being manipulated or, you know, just for the elections and then it's going to go up? Or you think it's just sort of the market?
I don't know. I think it's hard to tell what it's going to do after the elections, but I definitely think it's manipulated. You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Now, if these guys are making more and more profits all the time, it means they're selling the same. They're selling the same thing for more and more. I mean, how else could they make more money? Yeah,
exactly.
Unless they're selling more of it, and they're not.
Right.
Yeah. All right, Pat. I'll let you go charge your cell phone. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Here is Greg and Howell. Greg, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Oops, sorry, didn't work. There you go. Greg, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me on. This is actually the first time I got a chance to listen to your show. I usually work this time of night. But gas prices around my area in Howell is about $2.28. So usually I try to fill up once, and then I wait to get down to the inner city. I go towards Livonia, head down around that way, and fill up again where gas is normally 10 to 15 cents cheaper. It's about $2.15 in most places, depending on the gas, gas station. Usually Speedway is cheaper, but in reference to your Citgo where you buy your gas, I don't know if you've read much about it, but Citgo, the owner of Citgo is actually has some ties to Al Qaeda and terrorist connection. That the money that he's making and bringing in from Citgo is actually being shipped over to Iraq, and it's kind of going against us in a way.
Well, Greg, I don't know where you got that information from. I mean, because Hugo Chavez, who is this over-the-top opponent of Bush personally, he insulted Bush personally at the UN and everything like that. He has been a target for all sorts of charges, but I have to say I've never heard that one, and I would have to see some very, very strong evidence of that. I think there is none, and I would go so far as that certainly that Chavez has nothing to do with sending money. For one thing, he is in somewhat of a precarious position. It's not. Bush has tried to overthrow him before, backed this undemocratic coup against him as who's the elected president, Chavez, and that's why Chavez hates Bush so badly. It's kind of understandable. But none of his money is going there. In fact, he's doing things like giving cheap fuel oil through Citgo to poor people in Boston and New York and places like that. So, I've seen these letters that circulate around that say that Chavez wants to overthrow the U.S. government and stuff like that. I mean, that's insane. He's got this little country. And, by the way, it's a country that the United States corporations do an enormous amount of business with. So it's not like they're, these implacable opponents. He and Bush got an item. But essentially what Chavez wants to end is U.S. domination and economic domination of Latin America. But the companies that still remain there, the companies that are pumping the oil, and even Halliburton's there. He's just saying, look, we're getting a little better deal out of you guys, or we're not going to do it at all. And all the companies, except for ExxonMobil, have said, okay. So all the biggies are still down there. Trade with the U.S. is increasing. And like I say, I'd have to see some pretty strong evidence to support any contention like that. All right, I got to do a break, so thank you. Appreciate that very much. And we'll be right back. You want to call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com. We'll pay. WRIF.com.
On WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. It's our second hour. Welcome to it. 313-298-WRIF. Night Call brought to you this hour by Waking Up Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. Pardon me. Located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder and Warren. You can go to their website, wakingupstore.com. And Monday, October 30th, tomorrow, or today, right? Let me see. Yeah, we're 15 seconds into it. Through Sunday, November 5th, everything in the Waking Up store will be 20% off. For union members, the discount is 25% off. They got books. They got clothing. Check them out, Universal Mall. And this is their pre-holiday sale. Actually, the proprietor wrote me, told me what, that's not exactly what it is, something like that, though, pre-holiday. I'm thinking, I'm sorry. I'm thinking, you can't do this. You got to think on your feet. You can't, this is radio. You can't have big, thingos or big blank spaces. Excuse me. Let me clear my throat off. And this will be a blank space off mic. There we go. All right. Didn't want to do that in your ear. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. We are talking about things like gas prices, unions, unionization. And this is, I'll go through this quickly because there's a lot of you waiting. But while I was staying in New York, I was staying with friends, and we were looking at the front page of the New York Times. I read it here. Of course, he reads it. They read it because it's their hometown paper. But it's all there. It's all there right on the front page. The whole racket. And that's why, when you see things like 48% of Americans think that the gas prices are manipulated, I think 52% don't. They don't connect things up. All right, here real quickly. Hospitals try free basic care for uninsured. Tells a story about this woman, Dee Dee Dodd, who's got really bad diabetes. She's 38 years old, and she has no insurance at all. Getting sicker all the time, cutting her pills in half, stuff like that. She's rushed almost monthly to the emergency room, spent weeks in the intensive care unit, and accumulated almost $200,000 in unpaid bills. The nurses decided she's a frequent flyer, a repeat visitor whose ailments and expenses might be cured by regular care. What a concept, huh? Except in the United States, it doesn't exist. Not like other countries. We don't have a national health program like every other country in the world that is not a third world country has. So you have, what is it, 46.6 million, which is up by 7 million from 2000. So that's one of the products of the Bush racket, that they've driven another 7 million people off of insurance rolls. And so this woman is a small number, or oh no, I'm sorry, it's a hospital. It's one of the small number of hospital systems around the country that have done the math and acted on it. Officials decided that for many patients with chronic diseases, it would be cheaper to provide free preventive care than to absorb the high cost of repeated emergencies. Well, obviously, this applies to the other 46.6 million people our neighbors, our family, you, that don't have it, that only go to get medical care when you have something very, very severe. By the way, if you're ringing, hold on, please, because Al will be right to you in just a second. 313-298-WRIF. Here's another story. Patricia Meyer, 63-year-old quadriplegic and Medicare recipient, needs to replace the wheelchair she has used for 5 years. Normally, she could get it through her Medicare benefits to replace the power wheelchair, but WestMed, along with several other suppliers across the country, says it will no longer provide power wheelchairs to most Medicare recipients after November 15th, when cuts in Medicare reimbursements go into effect. So Bushco, this hideous racket for the wealthy, is taking quadriplegics and not letting them have wheelchairs. Quadriplegic, you say, oh, well, maybe they get strong arms. Well, not if you're quadriplegic. Do you know, and see, these things are all under the radar. It's all under the radar. So here we have that stock market's up past 12,000, and Bush is talking about how great the economy is. A lot of you are going to be going to college. If you're high school students, some of you in there now, a lot of parents, even if you're out there, you got 5-year-olds or 12-year-olds, you're thinking, what's this all going to cost? Well, tuition and other costs at public and private universities rose faster than inflation this year, the College Board said in a report released Tuesday. The board also found that in the last 5 years, gee, what happened in the last 5 years? That's when the racket really became 100%. Tuition and fees at public institutions rose more than at any other time in the past 30 years. So this is what's happened. This is a racket for the rich. Not to say that, you know, that it hadn't been in the past, but the what would you say? I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but the amount of looting has gone up astronomically. Astronomically, to the point where it's a 100% racket. Also here, where's our money going? Overhead costs have consumed more than half the budget of some reconstruction projects in Iraq. What? We're paying, of course, hundreds of millions of dollars, up into the billions, according to a government study, leaving far less money than expected to provide the oil, water, and electricity needed to improve the lives of Iraqis. Well, it's not happening. There was this press conference the other day with a general and the ambassador. Damn lights went out on them. The report provided the first official estimate that in some cases more money was being spent on housing and feeding employees. Let me rewrite that as the editor. The report provided the first official estimate that in some cases more U.S. taxpayer money was being spent on housing and feeding Iraqi employees, completing paperwork, and providing security than actual construction. These overhead costs have ranged from under 20% to much as 55% of the budget. Again, it's this enormous racket, right? Let me see what else is in here. I thought there was one more thing. Oh, yeah. This little thing here. It's a little note, again, below, beneath the radar from the Associated Press. A dirty little secret everyone in Washington knows, or at least should know, the vast majority of economists and budget analysts agree the ship of state is on a disastrous course and will founder on the reefs of economic disaster if nothing is done to correct it. Now, that's nice to know, isn't it? Paul Krugman in the New York Times said the other day that this stock market balloon of 12,000 is very similar to what happened in 1999, remember when the tech stocks crashed, or even worse, the late 1920s. Now, here is, an accountant says, she suggests recruiting a trusted celebrity, maybe Oprah, to sell a fiscal responsibility to the American people. Well, I guess we should take it over since the guys in the suits, the $1,500 suits, they can't figure it out. Or maybe they just figure out. Remember Marie Antoinette said, after us, the deluge? After us, everything was going to happen after she and Louis the whatever he was, the 14th or 18th or whatever. Right, too many Louis there for me to remember. And now this, who is this man here? David M. Walker. He is the head of the Government Accounting Office. And he says, Walker doesn't want to make balancing the federal government's books look sexy. He just wants to make it politically palatable. He has committed to touring the nation through the 2008 elections, talking to anyone who will listen about the fiscal black hole Washington has dug itself into. Again, I would add that to say the Bush racket and the corporations that are benefiting from the Bush racket have dug us into this fiscal black hole. He calls it a demographic tsunami that will come when the baby boom generation begins retiring and the recklessness of borrowing money from foreign lenders to pay for the operation of the U.S. government occurs. This wasn't the case in 2000 when Bush stole the first election. We had a surplus. But Bush cut taxes for the wealthy elite to the extent, and then started this war that had no basis in reality or truth. And so now we're in hock to foreign lenders. And this is all, this is, you know, someone's going to pay the piper. There's enough of you out there that have been either through, well, whatever it was true, have maxed out on your credit card. And you know what happens. You know what happens when that finally, you know, goes down the drain. Well, same thing could happen here as well, except on a grand scale. I think what the racket Bushco is depending on is that China and Japan and London and the people that hold these bonds that we're, by the way, we're paying high interest on, you and I, and our tax dollars, is that they're not going to pull the rug out from under us because they would screw everything up. All right. Let's go back to our phones. Here is Dave in Marysville. Dave, hey, it's Peter Werby. I was just in your town. I took the car ferry from Sombra to Marysville about a week ago.
That's Marine City, Peter.
Oh, it is. It is Marine City. I'm sorry.
Yes.
You're right.
Yes. I called to talk about the before I say that, I want to say happy Samhain for the Wiccans.
Okay.
And the autumnal equinox that's coming up in 2 days. But the gas prices, I noticed today we came home from church, and I noticed that in Myers it was $2.07.
Really?
My wife said, well, she says, I think I want to get some gas. I said, you better get in there now. And we pulled up the street a little farther and got the total, and it was $2.25. And then we pulled up a little farther, and it was $2.27 at the Shell station. So she dropped me off and went back and got gas. You know, and I commute every day from here to Troy.
Wow.
To work.
That's a ways.
And yes, it is. And on Grosbeck Highway, there's quite a few gas stations there, and one of them is a Citgo station. It's one of the few you see. You don't see very many Citgo stations. But they're always the cheapest also on there between Hall Road and Cass.
You can go there. I think there's even on my website, but if not, you could just go to like Citgo on, you know, Google it, and they have a list of all their stations. They're actually cutting back on their retail outlets in the U.S. because they, in order to supply all the ones, for instance, at the 7-Eleven stores, they had to buy 300,000 gallons, a day or a week or so, something like that in order to just, you know, they don't have enough refinery capacity in the United States.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to
But before you do that, I just want to bring up one thing that struck me. You said when your wife saw the under, what was it, 208 or 206 or whatever, she said, wow. Well, we've gotten used to that. And, I mean, that's their deal. They pump it up to $3, and we're going, $3? Let's, you know, let's have a revolution. And then they drop it down to, like, 210, and we go, phew, hey, wow, that's great. And then they'll bring it up to 320. And we'll go, hey, that's awful. And then they'll drop it down to 240. So, you know what I'm saying? They're taking two steps forward, one step back, steps forward, one step back. But they're just driving the price up more and more.
Oh, I know it. They watch it every day. We watch it every day when we go down there. And sometimes it's lower. Sometimes it's higher.
Yeah.
It's really strange. Something has happened within the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. Where it's been like that. I mean, it used to be kind of predictable. that it was higher here and it was lower there. Now you don't know. It's strange.
Well, it is. But rather than getting on to that other thing, let me get somebody else on the air. Thanks for calling. Sorry I confused your town. Here's Joe from Hamtown, Hamtramck. You're on the air, Joe. Hi, it's Peter Werby on WRIF. You too. Oops, sorry, wait a minute here. There you go. Go ahead, Joe. You're on the air. Whoa.
I talked to you last week.
Well, you're on a bad cell phone, man.
Push your bags. I've been on the show waiting for you.
You know what we got to do, Joe? Joe, you're just breaking up big time. You got to go. I'm going to put you back on hold. And, I can't even do that. This something is definitely wrong with this. This sucks. I can't. The functions on this are not working. Joe, I'm going to call back when you got a better connection. I think there's one open line. I'm going to have to because we couldn't understand you. Here is EP in Ann Arbor. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Good. I've been listening to you for years. I used to listen to you a lot even when the Detroit unions were getting broken up over the newspaper years ago when I started first listening to you.
Oh, yeah.
You had a great show.
Well, thanks.
Number one, I wanted to talk about the gas prices, and not really. I agree with the two steps forward and the one step back, but I don't know. My beliefs are this, that they're totally being manipulated for the elections, and then even if you take it to the elections, I mean, nowadays it almost seems like there isn't even a difference between, you know, a Republican and Democrat, and they throw all these issues out there, so all of us will run around like little sheep while they go ahead, you know, push all this other stuff under the radar and push bills and laws through, and I mean, they're all bonesmen. They all went to Yale together.
Sure.
So I guess for me nowadays, it's very upsetting because of the fact that so many Americans are just uninformed about the real agenda that's going on nowadays. So they bitch about, you know, abortion and the gas prices. And, I mean, even that guy that called in from Howell a few minutes ago and not taking anything away from him, it's like, well, he's giving money to Al-Qaeda. You know, I mean, nowadays we've had laws passed through the Senate where the U.S. military can take anybody in the United States. It doesn't matter what city, what state, nationality, nothing. They can detain you, not charge you, and claim you as a terrorist and take your children in nowadays. I'm getting a little nervous living in the States, and I was kind of wondering what you thought about that.
Well, certainly that the Constitution has been shredded by this law passed by Bush, this Military Commissions Act, which is absolutely insane and absolutely unconstitutional. It legalizes torture. It destroys 800 years of guarantee of court judicial review of the accused, and on and on and on. What's the word for it? They clear people from the past for crimes that may have been committed, and on and on and on like that. And actually, these people, I mean, I believe are truly mad, truly mad, and it's not even necessary what they're doing. I mean, if there hasn't been any terrorist attack since 2001 and this Bush racket is finally doing its job, it didn't do its job before September 11th or we wouldn't have been attacked, well, good for them. They're just doing what they're supposed to, what we would expect a government to do to protect us. But these other things that they're doing, turning the United States officially into a torture state, violating the Geneva Accords that not only that, you know, people who protect terrorists, they protect our soldiers. That's what it's all about. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. In fact, I wanted to... where did that all go? Yeah. Bush says that the U.S. doesn't torture prisoners. And then, so why do they... Why did they... and then they admit that, you know, because they outlawed this waterboarding where you make people feel by dumping water on their face that it is a like they're drowning. This is something, by the way, that when was done to our people. Here, let's see here. 21 years earlier. I know. Here. 1968, the Washington Post published a front page photograph of a U.S. soldier supervising the questioning of a captured North Vietnamese soldier who was being held down as water was poured on his face while his nose and mouth were covered by a cloth. The picture taken 4 days earlier near Da Nang had a caption that said the technique, quote, induced a flooding sense of suffocation and drowning meant to make him talk. Now, what if that was done to our soldiers? Because you got to remember, everybody from Al-Qaeda to the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to, I mean, whoever the United States was fighting, they had the same regard for their own troops, Nazis, the Nazi troops, the German Wehrmacht. They thought that they were good and righteous people fighting for their homeland and the values that they held sacred. The Vietnamese felt that they were repelling this imperial force that had invaded and occupied their country, destroyed it, killed millions of people. So what if they would have done that to our soldiers in Vietnam and thought, well, what the hell? You know, we can get information about these guys. We can get troop movements. And I mean, we would have been pretty upset. Same thing in Iraq. Now, 21 years earlier, 1947, the United States charged a Japanese officer, Yukio Asano, with war crimes for carrying out another form of waterboarding on a U.S. citizen, and then it describes it. Asano was sentenced to 15 years of hard labor, according to Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts. He told his colleagues this last Thursday during the debate on military commissions legislation. He said, "We punish people with 15 years of hard labor when waterboarding was used against Americans in World War II. So somehow, under Bushko, torture's okay when we do it. But what's going to happen when it then happens to our troops? Because, I mean, that's the whole thing. You want to make that illegitimate in world affairs. For one thing, they tortured this guy who they're accusing of, and now Cheney has said, it's okay. You can dunk him." He said, "Well, I wasn't talking about waterboarding." What else? What are you dunking? Like you're bobbing for apples or something like that? Or one of those clown dunk boards or something of that sort? Bush saying they don't waterboard. And he said that Cheney didn't mean waterboarding. Well, where did the term come from? Why is it now in the Army manual that you can't do it? Would you agree that a dunk in the water is a no-brainer if it can save lives? Well, maybe that's what they'll think when they capture some of our men. And there was something I was looking for here. Oh, yeah. This colleague, Sheikh Mohammed, who they suspect is the mastermind of the attacks on 911. Well, after someone's been in custody for 5 years and tortured, there's no other word for it. It's not rough interrogation or what have you. He was tortured. And, in fact, it says somewhere in this article, I can't put my finger on it, that a lot of the information that he came up with was not even... it didn't do any good because that it, we start torturing people, they tell you a lot. It's abolished. Waterboarding. Let me see. I'm looking here. Oh, this is Senator Graham of South Carolina. "Waterboarding, in my opinion, would cause extreme physical and psychological pain and suffering." This is a Republican senator. "It is very much could be run afoul of the War Crimes Act." This is something that's supported by Bush and Cheney and the CIA that would make them war criminals, which I would say they qualify as. Senator Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, says it could very much open people up to prosecution under the War Crimes Act as well as a violation of the Detainees Treatment Act. That's why contained in there is this escape clause for everyone that's already done that, has already violated these laws, to not be able to be prosecuted. Now, the government says that it's going to try between 60 and 80 of people at Guantanamo. They've had hundreds and hundreds of people there that were brought there under the most suspect, in the most suspect manner. Again, many of them flown off to other countries by the United States and allow them to be tortured and go, "Oh, well, gee, I guess they weren't, didn't have anything to do with anything. Sorry about that, that we were pulling your fingernails out." But now the Pentagon may need hundreds of millions of dollars in additional funding from Congress to build courtrooms, housing, and other infrastructure required to run military trials for terrorism suspects held at Guantanamo Bay. So here more is going to go down this rat hole, this black hole in space that the Bushko racket has put together. Say, well, what about these terrorists? Well, for one thing, they have completely poisoned the terrain on which you can prosecute people because the procedures under which internationally and recognized by the United States Constitution to stop arbitrary treatment and arbitrary prosecution and follow some rules of law have been so abrogated by the way these people have been handled. If somebody committed mass murder, if they murdered one people or they murdered 3,000 people, what the hell should have happened? They should have brought them to trial. You can say, well, they want to get the information out of them. Well, all right, so they waterboarded them. So they tortured them. When did they do it? Did they do it like 2 months ago? No. They did it back then. So why weren't they brought to trial in New York State Court? You wouldn't have all of this. Because this is all political, all political, all political. All right, let's take some more calls. Tell me what you think. Here is Matt. Matt's in Warren. Matt, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Doing good.
A couple of things. Just to touch base on the gentleman from Marysville, I commute from Warren to Marysville. Down in Warren, there's a lot of gas stations, so it's hard to kind of keep tabs on them. The main strip in Marysville has... four gas stations on it. One of them is the total that he mentioned. And if you kind of pay close attention, that total gas station will mark up their price in the morning. And they don't do this every day, but they'll mark up their price in the morning. The other stations on the strip will follow suit. And in the afternoon, the total station will drop their price or late morning.
Okay.
I don't know if there's any other word for it than price gouging. And another aspect of that I just kind of wanted to comment on is the fact that OPEC will announce on a day, on any given day, that they're going to reduce production by, say, 1.5 million barrels of oil a day.
Uh-huh.
Now, regardless of actual supply, because of the price is driven by supply and demand, regardless of whether or not this loose conglomeration of mainly Arab states follows suit with that, because really, who wants to be the guy to turn the tap down? Because they're just basically squeezing their own funds. So, regardless of whether or not the price drops or the supply drops by that 1.5 million barrels of oil a day, immediately our gas stations here in the United States go up.
It does indeed. You know, actually, your call is beginning to break up. You must be on a cell phone. But here, let me just give you this information and the rest of the listeners as well. Zach from Waterford wrote in, and he gives us a website, DetroitGasPrices.com, DetroitGasPrices.com, and you can get it from there. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Now, also, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com, and somewhere in there, let's see, over on the left, where is it? Oh, yeah. There's a statue, drawing, I guess, of the Statue of Liberty with a gas mask on, and it says it's all about oil. And then if you go there to that page, it gives you a comparison of gas prices all over the world. And always in Caracas, in Venezuela, which we were talking about, gas is usually around 14 or 15 cents a gallon. Amazing. All right, let's see. Do we have time? Yeah, we got time for another call. Sure. Now, on the other hand, here's Dave in South Lyon who has kind of a contrary opinion. Dave, hey, it's Peter Werbe. You think high gas prices are good?
Yeah, thanks, Peter, for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Yeah, I do have kind of a different point of view about gas prices. First of all, I definitely share everybody's concern about the price. I don't like paying a lot. And it is painful for everybody at the pump. But the way I see it, though, is if you kind of look at how things go, it seems like whenever gas prices are really high, that's when we get a lot of discussion about how we need to reduce our driving of SUVs. We need to put more money into mass transit. We need to look at smart growth as opposed to suburban sprawl. And all of these issues seem to come kind of to the forefront when gas prices are high. And when the gas prices fall back down, then we stop talking about these things. And it just seems to me that the only way we're really going to ever break this addiction to oil and a lot of the bad habits we have is for gas prices to go up, which will make the public angry. And then maybe something will happen.
Well, I do hear you, and that's not an unusual argument, that the idea that we're going to have profligate gas consumption. By the way, in Caracas, where I visited this January, where gasoline is 15 cents a gallon, the city is awfully polluted. Everybody can drive, and everybody's got old beaters, and you don't have to worry about gas. I mean, people are very poor there, but if you're paying 15 cents a gallon, what the hell? You go two blocks, boom, you drive there. But what it has to be is a society-wide effort and program to end oil as the main fuel, in fact, fossil fuels in general. It could be done. Might have to be some change of lifestyle, but we have a couple choices. We can either keep fighting wars for oil. At best, that's the best thing that's going to happen. The best thing that's going to happen with the continuation of our addiction to oil is we're going to fight wars. The worst thing is we're going to choke ourselves out with the pollution that the planet is not going to recover from. So gas prices are good in a way, like being middle class, they don't hurt me very well, and I know you recognize this, Dave. But who it hurts when it's done, I don't know if you'd call it piecemeal or whatever, but just sort of allowed to happen, it's the poor and the working class, people that where that takes a big bite. I mean, if you're making $8 an hour and you're paying $3 a gallon, that really hurts. If you're making, you know, I'm not making this, but if you're making $100,000 a year, what the hell do I care? Just a few more dimes. So there has to be, I agree with you 100%. There has to be a look at how we are fueling the energy demands of not only this country but of the world and the World Wildlife Federation. In fact, maybe I'll mention that when we come back because we've got to take a break. But we are over what they call overshooting our carrying capacity. In other words, we don't have enough planet here to support the life that we're living on it. All right, Dave, thanks for bringing it up. Appreciate it.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIM.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. This is our final segment of you calling in. So you can do it right now. Some open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-WRIF. I said that, but I want to give you the number. 313-298-9743. I guess about oil prices and all that, but some things that relate to it. Also, we're open line as usual. This just in, St. Louis. What am I going to talk about? Now what'd you think? St. Louis ranked the most dangerous city in the United States. So they just beat our Tigers for the top honor in the Major League Baseball, but they jumped into first place. So, of course, which is a list that no one wants to be the top of. And guess which city was number two? Well, it turns out to be just like the World Series, because Detroit was number two. Flint was right in there. Let's see, where all of a sudden I've lost on here where all this was. A lot of crime increasing in general, and you'll see that. I mean, we went through a period of high crime in the 80s, and then it all slowed down during the 90s, and there obviously is a correlation between poverty and crime. And it's not just people stealing to get bread on their plates, but I think the being sunk into poverty creates a mindset that that has a larger percentage of people willing to prey on their neighbors. I just saw this. Oh, yeah. Safest city in 2005 was Brick, New Jersey. I mean, what the hell? Wouldn't you expect it to be Brick, New Jersey, or Amherst, New York, or Mission Viejo, California? Second most dangerous city was Detroit, followed by Flint, Michigan, and Compton, California. Now, I don't get any sense at all when I go into Detroit that I'm in any danger whatsoever. I just live one suburb north, and you know, something about a mile and a half away from Detroit as it is. And but you know, what do? I go downtown, I go to the Cass Corridor, you know, stuff around Wayne State University. Yeah, so that's not, but I think it's, you know, for in the residential neighborhoods, that's probably where the real problems lie, huh? Okay, 313-298-WRIF, and oh yeah, I was going to tell you about this as well. Humans are stripping nature at an unprecedented rate and will need two planets worth of natural resources every year by 2050 on current trends, this according to the World Wildlife Federation. Populations of many species, from fish to mammals, have fallen by about a third from 1970 to 2003, largely because of human threats such as pollution, clearing of forests, and overfishing. According to the Director General, James Lippe, he says that for more than 20 years, we have exceeded the Earth's ability to support a consumptive lifestyle that is unsustainable, and we cannot afford to continue down this path. Now, most of us strive to consume as much as possible. I remember somebody said, you're always crapping about the environment, Pete, and you're flying all over the world and all over the country. Well, I would be willing to give that up. I mean, I'm not going to do it by myself. But if there's a recognition that we are at an environmental crisis, which we are, we're also at a financial crisis, we're also at a social crisis, and we kind of look at all this piecemeal, kind of think, oh, finally it's dawned on people that Bush is not managing this country very well. Oh, we finally come to the conclusion that the war in Iraq is bad, and on like that, and that gas prices are too high. If the whole world, according to Leap, let's call him, if everyone around the world lived as those in America, we would need five planets to support us. Now, that is what's called from the ecology, what do you call those people? Not philosophers. There's a word I'm looking for here. Writers, let's just call them. I can't think of the guy's name right now. Overshoot. There's a book called Overshoot. We've overshot our carrying capacity. And that's pretty easy to understand, right? If, say, you were just growing out of your, eating out of your garden, and you grew not enough food. Well, yeah, that'd be the deal. Well, we're doing that on a planetary basis, and like next year you can grow more food maybe. If you go, oh, gee, I didn't have enough food. Well, if we start stripping the resources of, like, forests and overfishing and destruction of habitat and the elimination of species, Yeah, this could turn up to be pretty ugly in a way that you have to really go to science fiction to look for. And most of us either think the problem is so huge that we can't deal with it as individuals, and we can't. And as long as we have these oil maniacs at the helm, we're not even going to get close to it. I don't know. I mean, at least somebody like Gore. He and Clinton didn't do much good about the environment when they were in there, better than their predecessors, but they weren't at least after it with an axe the way Bush Co. is. Now, let's go back to our phones. Hey, at 1 o'clock, which is just in a few minutes, we're going to be interviewing the eminent historian Howard Zinn. He's going to be in Detroit November 5th, next Sunday. And if you'd like to go see him, pardon me, you go to my website, go to the calendar, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. All right, let's go to Steve. Steve's been waiting a long time patiently. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Go ahead.
What's up, Peter? How you doing?
Good. Thanks.
I called to talk about the gas prices, but then you went ahead and started going off about the environment and such and how we're going to overshoot our limit. And honestly, you know, the only thing that comes to mind when you say that is, you seen the movie The Matrix?
You know, I don't know why I never have, but I never have.
Well, the bad guy in there, the supposed bad guy, is a computer agent. And he tells it just like it is. Human beings are a disease. All we do, we're just like a virus. We consume, we spread, we consume some more, we spread, we consume some more. And until we get things under control, we're going to keep doing that. And like you said, we're digging ourselves right into a hole that we're never going to be able to get out of until, you know, we figure out a way to get off this planet.
Right. Well, here's another good film. I think they just re-released it on DVD, Soylent Green.
Mm-hmm.
You ever see that?
I think I've caught parts of it, not the whole thing, though.
It's a Charlton Heston film. It's actually pretty interesting. It's... things have been kind of ruined, and the people are fed Soylent Green. I won't give away the ending, but it's pretty ghastly.
Well, with the gas prices, the thing that we just need to get off of fossil fuels completely, because, once again, this also ties into the environment. The longer we use these things, you know, the more racketeering we got going on in the government. I don't care if it's Republicans like Bush or Democrats like Kennedy. It doesn't matter. They're all in it together. And they don't care about the little guy. Now, I'm sure there are a few good politicians out there who do care about the little guy, but most of them don't. They care about, you know, filling their wallets up.
Sure.
And, you know, that's the only way we're going to really solve this issue is to come up with a way to get completely off of fossil fuels. If we could do that, then, you know, I think a lot of things would turn around. And, of course, then, on the other hand, you know, as soon as we get off of fossil fuels and we, you know, let's say we get into hydrogen or whatever, you know,
huh?
Hydrogen comes around. Next thing you know, all the big wigs are going to be tapping into the hydrogen market.
Well, yeah, it's okay if they do that or if they tap into the photovoltaic cells or wind power. You know, let's get them to do that. All right, well, here's Ed and Taylor. I think Ed has some suggestions. Ed, hey, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Yeah, Pete. There's a store in Toledo called the Andersons. It's sort of like a Myers. It sells all kinds of stuff. Some of it's more specialty, but they got into ethanol refining, and their stock was going up last summer. And, you know, everybody was saying, well, you know, invest in that and everything. But then here comes Marathon, and they partner with them. And it just seems like ethanol is eventually, from what I've read of them, oil companies are starting to diversify into ethanol and that. And just they'll probably just take that over by the time, you know, if they switch over to ethanol 10, 20 years or whatever with all the corn and that, probably be, you know, setting the price for that and buy everybody out. There won't be a competition from anybody else.
No, that of course, sure. I mean, as long as they control resources, they could do that. And there is a problem with growing corn. I mean, corn is the way it's grown here by these agribusinesses. Is you know, taking over more and more land, and I mean, I don't know. Maybe what we really need is a political revolution, which would address all of the problems in terms of the needs of the majority of this of people on this planet. And if we like capitalism, I mean, we might even, if we still want bosses and profits and stuff like that, we could. arrange it so these guys just wouldn't get so much and couldn't control everything. I mean, that's the reform version of it. And that would be sweet, just, you know, nothing else. All right, thanks a lot, Ed. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here's Joe in Lincoln Park. Joe, Peter Werby, you're on the air. Wait a minute here. I'm not doing this right. You know, this is actually this phone. Let me try it again. There you go. There's
here
Joe.
I am.
Joe,
hey,
Joe.
Steve, what's going on?
Hi.
Hey, it's funny you mentioned St. Louis, man. I've been all the way across this country this year, and Colorado, St. Louis, Kansas City, all over the place, and it's definitely not America the Beautiful. I mean, it quite looks like hell. St. Louis is one big ghetto, and it does kind of looks like Detroit in many ways. You know, abandoned houses, dumps, and that looks like the way this nation's going.
Well, of course, like you would in Guatemala or Mexico or someplace like that. It depends on where you go. If you go to the smaller percentage of middle class or wealthy areas, gee, it looks swell, looks great, looks everything looks fine. But then when you start going down into you know, the poorer areas and the really poor areas, then it starts to get dangerous. Then it starts to look real bad. And again, we got to remember, this isn't Mexico or Guatemala. We are the richest country in the world.
Well, perhaps. Like you mentioned gas prices, too. Of course they're fixed. Everything seems to be fixed in this country, especially our voting machines. Wasn't that long ago, maybe last week or the week before. It was stated that Bush and Karl Rove, didn't seem to be that worried about the midterm elections, and I was thinking maybe our voting machines are fixed, and I guess a lot of other people are worried about that, too. So.
Well, they should be. They should be.
We've got no country, no elections. We've got nothing. Thanks, Pete.
And we're trying, thank you, and we're trying to export democracy. I love it. Here is another Joe. Joe, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
No. Joe.
What?
Hamtramck.
Oh, go ahead, Joe.
Remember Bush-O-Matic last week?
Oh, yeah, right.
Bush-O-Matic.
I was gonna steal it, and I forgot.
About this election coming up, but the main thing we're missing out in the unions, we're talking union, I belong to a couple of unions, Teamsters, and no education for these kids today about unions. I think everybody's supposed to make $20 an hour. You know, they don't get educated. The schools don't preach unions. They don't talk about that.
Can you turn your radio all the way off,
Joe?
Turn
your radio down. Yeah.
Down,
get a little feedback going.
Yeah.
But, they're not educated well enough. They don't know about unions. Everyone thinks you're supposed to make $20 an hour. I mean, we fought hard to get where we're at. I've been in there 27 years.
Wow.
You know, trying to get where we're at today, and then unions get a bad name.
Well, I don't understand. Well, there are some aspects. I mean, unions got kind of, fat and self-serving. Now some of them are beginning to really push out and understand they got to organize people that haven't been organized before. And I just hope in the near future, it's not too late.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and it's hard because you struggle. You try to make a living. And, again, with the Bush-O-Matics, everyone making $5 an hour, I mean, that's what they want. That's what the Republicans want. And, you know, we're just trying to struggle to make a living and put food on there. There's no more it's all just the middle class. There's no rich people. It's just people struggling to make a dollar.
There you go. All right, Joe. Thank you. I appreciate your call. Let's see. We got time for a couple more calls. You want to call in 313-298-WRIF. What's going to be the big, what they call the October surprise, something that's going to pull the election out of the hat for the ruling racket? And let's just hope. I mean, I always used to say, I got fired from some job. I don't even want to say, hey, I don't care. Cool. I used to do radio for the United Auto Workers, and they hated it because I said the Democrats were the other half of the ruling racket. And there's a lot of truth in that, but they've been out of power so long that they actually seem like reformers now compared to the racketeers that are in office. But so usually at the end, Bushko will do something. You know, there'll probably be another Osama bin Laden tape threatening us and... that'll work for them. But the other thing that's going to happen is that they arrange to have the U.S.-backed special tribunal in Iraq. They've set November 5th as the date for the announcement of the verdict and sentence in the first trial of Saddam Hussein. Well, how convenient that is, isn't it? Absolutely amazing. according to Scott Horton, who is who? He's chairman of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association and professor of law at Columbia University. He said that most observers expected the date would be much later, but it seems to have been moved up. It's kind of like the gas prices, isn't it? It will be front page news in the papers on Monday, the day before the election. This is designed to show progress in Iraq. Now, active duty troops are voicing their dissent from U.S. policy. There are over 110 active duty troops are petitioning Congress. You can go to appealforredress.org. Appealforredress.org. That's from the First Amendment. The Congress can't restrict the people from assembling for redress of grievances. Now let's go to Scott. Scott is in Westland. Scott, hi. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Well, no, I have two quick anecdotes for you. Having George Bush in the White House is like having Tom Monahan own the Tigers. This is strictly straight off the cable thing. I didn't even watch the show, but this was in the the guide. War Stories with Oliver North. If you want to catch up with that on CNN, Dick Cheney admits that we're going to win in Iraq, but it's going to take 20 to 25 years. So we're talking like Northern Ireland, you know, or Palestine or something like that. And so, well, God help us all, you know, right?
Well, they've gone up to, 10 years. They say we're going to be, 2010.
He admitted that. He said it's going to take 20 to 25 years. Dick Cheney said that to Oliver North, you know, on Fox.
That's amazing. Well,
I'm laughing at that. I get sardonic laughter. Forgive me.
Well, no, it's laughter to keep from crying that we've allowed two elections to be stolen, a war based on lies to continue as long as it has. All right, Scott, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. These active duty troops are voicing their dissent from U.S. policy. And you got to remember that the troops very frequently in wars have been the ones that stop it. There was some talk after World War II of some people like Patton and all that wanted to go on and attack the Soviet Union. And the troops just said, no, bring the boys home. And also certainly GIs and active duty GIs during the Vietnam War were at the end, the leadership of what ended the war. So here we have perhaps the leading edge of it. About 118 members of the U.S. military plan to petition Congress asking that U.S. forces be withdrawn from Iraq and brought home. And again, you can go to appealforredress.org. Did I mention this last week that there is $20 million squirreled away in the war budget that Bush and Congress just passed? It's for a commemoration of success, so it's going to be this triumph of the empire. I don't know, they're going to bring back Al-Qaeda heads on their shields or something. I mean, it's just totally repulsive. And yeah, here, troops to stay in Iraq till 2010. I love it. All right. I think our guest, I'm trying to think, I can't remember, I did the, before I went to New York on Monday, I did the interviews, but Howard Zinn, and if you don't know who Howard Zinn is, just Google Zinn. If you haven't read People's History of the United States, I thought it was a million copies sold, and turns out, in fact, I think that's the first question I asked him, now it's like 1,700,000. And the reason it's so popular, because it tells the truth about our history. And if we know the truth about our history, we can have a rational and reasonable future. We've got to sweep away these madmen that have us in their grasp. All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We'll do it all again next week.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sexy, can they hear? Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you, and it's also a pleasure to welcome back someone who's been on the Peter Werby Show several times before, but even more so because our guest is going to be in Detroit on Sunday, November 5th. It's going to be at the Cranbrook Peace Foundation's 19th Annual Peace Lecture and Award, and any number of individuals who are world-renowned for their personal witness for peace. This has been given out since 1988, and many speakers have a wide range of folks, including Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel, Senator George Mitchell, Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Representative Dennis Kucinich, entertainer Pete Seeger. This time, it's historian Howard Zinn. So it's a pleasure to welcome Howard Zinn back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Peter. Always good to talk with you.
And I suspect that people are familiar with you, if for no other reason than I probably mention your most famous book, A People's History of the United States, at least once during every talk show that I do, because I think it's such an important document. And it's not solely subjective on my part. It is the best-selling history book of all times. I think we talked maybe a year or a year and a half ago when sales of it had reached a million. That's astounding, isn't it?
It is. I'm astounded. my editor at Harper College is astounded. So, you know, there are surprises all over the place. It is now, I might say, 1.7 million in sales. It still sells, you know, over 100,000 copies each year.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, when maybe I'm misjudging when we talked about that. When did it hit a million?
Hit a million probably in 2002.
Okay, so it could have been five years ago. Well, I'll bet you, and my memory's not good on this, you may tell me if I've asked you this before. Speaking of history, one of a very famous Detroiter, Henry Ford, famously said, "History is bunk." In other words, history is supposed to be the chronicling of what came before us. But Ford thought that it was all nonsense, that you could construe it in any way imaginable, that to come out to kind of show what you wanted. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think Henry Ford was half right. There is history which is bunk, and then there is history which is very useful. And I suspect that he did not want people, knowing Henry Ford, knowing his disposition to stop unionism in his factories and hire gunmen and spies to prevent unionism, knowing his kind of element of anti-Semitism, I suspect that Ford did not want the kind of history that would expose corporate power, the kind of history, in other words, that would be perhaps harmful to people like himself, because it would educate people about what corporations have done in this country to working people, and educate them about world affairs, about which he didn't know very much. So, you know, sure, I think Henry Ford would not like the kind of history that I believe in, a history which exposes what the authorities do, a history which tells the stories of of the struggles of working people and black people and Native Americans and women. And he, for him, that history would be bunk. For me, the history that he would like, and I suspect that even though he said history is bunk, I suspect that there's a kind of history that he would like, and that is a history that will exalt the industrial leaders of the country for making our country so rich and prosperous, you know, ignoring the fact that it was the working people of this country who did all those things. He would probably exalt the kind of history that made heroes of our warriors, our Andrew Jacksons and Theodore Roosevelts. And, you know, I would suspect that for him that history was not bunk. So, as I say, you know, we just, Henry Ford and I, although he doesn't know this, have a different viewpoint on history.
Now, I think some would say, in response to that, I'm going to be the devil's advocate. Some of my listeners think I am in any event.
Do they think that you're the devil's advocate or that you're the devil?
Well, just as advocate. I don't know. I haven't risen to only as advocate. But the argument would be made that a people's history of the United States is ideologized history, whereas the others are objective, because we know that Andrew Jackson was the president. We know that Henry Ford began the assembly line here and changed the nature of industrial production. And all they're trying to do is chronicle events. Howard Zinn is trying to make political points.
They're right.
Okay.
I am trying to make political points. And I have a point of view. My point of view is that simply telling about Andrew Jackson, you know, as one of our presidents, or Andrew Jackson, who sort of opened up the doors of the White House to people who didn't wear ties. And my point of view is that kind of history has a point of view. It pretends to be objective. It pretends to give you just facts. But it chooses the facts that it gives you. My point is that there's no such thing as objective history, and no such thing as history without a point of view, because all history is a selection of data out of an infinite amount of data, and what you select shows your point of view. And if you select the story of Theodore Roosevelt that shows him overcoming his physical disabilities as a youth, supporting conservation measures, or riding up San Juan Hill in the glorious victory over the Spanish troops in the Spanish-American War. You know, when you concentrate on those facts, you are ignoring other facts, but you have a point of view. So it's always one point of view versus another point of view. But one difference is that very often the people who pretend to give you objective history, who pretend to give you the facts, don't tell you they have a point of view. They give you a big fat textbook, and which is so fat you assume it must have everything in it, and which doesn't seem to take any positions, but takes a position by what it gives you and what it omits. I think they are being dishonest, therefore, when they claim to be giving you objective history. And I'm trying to tell you very candidly that I am interested in certain things in history, that I want to bring out certain things that haven't been brought out before, and that my aim in all of this is to create a greater social consciousness among people, to let them know that their interests and the interests of the government are rarely together, to let them know that wars are usually fought on the basis of lies, to let them know that, you know, the economic progress made in this country was made on the backs of workers, and that people only won whatever victories they won, the 8-hour day for working people, an end to racial segregation for black people, a greater consciousness of the rights of women. Whatever was won not by acts of the president or Congress or the Supreme Court, but was won by the struggles of ordinary people themselves. And so the point of my history is to give people who read it a greater consciousness of their own role in history, of their own power, of the necessity for them to take a part in history rather than allowing the people in power to go their own way, because going their own way, the way of people in power, is usually detrimental to the interests of the majority of people in the country.
Howard Zinn is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. We're talking in part about one of his many books, A People's History of the United States. And Howard Zinn is going to be giving the 19th annual Cranbrook Peace Foundation's annual peace lecture and award ceremony. And it's going to be in the Riverview Ballroom of Cobo Hall on November 5th, a Sunday. And you can go to cranbrookpeace.org and click on event tickets for information. A lot of other activity around Howard Zinn's lecture as well. That sounds so dry. Lecture talk, I think, would be better. Because, but let me go back. In fact, that strikes me when you said that you were surprised that your history book has sold 1,700,000 copies. People should know that you can get on the New York Times bestseller list by selling 10% of that, or even less. Are you surprised of the interest in history? Because normally it's what makes teenagers groan, because we're going to have to memorize generals and presidents and dates and stuff like this.
It's true that I was surprised by how people took up my book with enthusiasm, because, as you say, I understood that most people are turned off by history. You know, they take courses in history which are very dry and not inspiring, not provocative. So I was surprised. I didn't reckon with, didn't really understand the extent to which people were hungry for a different kind of history. And when they started to read my history, and they realized from the first chapter on, from the time I tell things about Columbus that they never knew before, I was surprised that people were hungry for a different kind of history. I hadn't really thought that through, but that, it turned out that way. My editors were surprised too, and to me it's been very heartening. It means that while people may groan, as you say, through the sort of dull recitations of history, that they want something more, they want something different, and when somebody presents something different to them, they respond. And so they've responded to my book, and they've responded to other books, that have tried to give them a different, more dynamic, more critical, more inspiring view of history.
Yeah, and there's been spin-offs of this. I know that there's a Voices of a People's History of the United States that was done with Anthony Arnov, who I interviewed recently. And is there audio? Isn't there audio recordings?
Yes, there is. There's an audio recording of parts of A People's History read by Matt Damon, the actor, whom I've known for a very long time, and who very graciously agreed to read this audio. And there have been other, spin-offs, which, well, right now we're working on trying to do a television documentary based on A People's History. That's always difficult to do, but we're working on it. There's been, all sorts of things going on.
This is you're not back with Fox Network
no,
again.
No.
All right. Now, that was starting to take shape quite a few years ago.
Fox, I guess Fox suddenly read the book.
Yeah.
After signing contracts to produce a television series, somebody there read the book. Maybe Murdoch read the book for the first time and said, no, this won't go. And then HBO took it up, and then HBO decided that they didn't want to go. Television has, I can't really understand exactly what's behind them, but I know that, they think of the market, they think. And so I'm hopeful now with this new approach to a documentary that with Chris Moore, who has a lot of experience in Hollywood, with the friend of Ben Affleck, Affleck and Matt Damon, and has worked with them and worked with them on their film Good Will Hunting, and he's going to work with me on this TV documentary, and maybe something will come of it.
You mentioned Good Will Hunting. In that, the Matt Damon character is arguing with Robin Williams about who's a more important author, Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky. Did you know that was in the works?
Well, no. By the way, Peter, no, it wasn't a contest between me and Noam Chomsky exactly, but although Noam Chomsky is mentioned at some point, but I did know that would happen. I didn't know I would be mentioned, or the book would be mentioned in that movie, but Matt Damon's mother, and as I say, I've known Matt Damon for a long time. His mother is a very good friend of ours, of me and my wife, and she invited us to the Boston premiere of Good Will Hunting, and as we walked into the movie theater for the screening, she said to me, "Howard, there's a surprise in this for you." And so, sure enough, the surprise came.
That was extraordinary. We talked about this a little. The word, if I'm using it right, I remember from my own college history class, historiography. In other words, the methodology of telling history and a people's history of the United States. And I think, in a way, you spoke to that. The reason that is in there is because this is not great men and wars and what have you, but sees the common people, or the description of how they lived, as the motor of history. Am I correct?
No, that's absolutely right. You know, very often when some people reacting to my book will say, you know, you're putting down Columbus and you're putting down Theodore Roosevelt and even Woodrow Wilson and even Kennedy and Johnson, you know, you're criticizing them for their lack of sensitivity to certain issues. And people say, but don't you think we need our heroes? And my response is, yes, I think we do need people to look up to. We do need people to admire. That's true of young people. Young people need to be able to point to certain figures in history as role models. So, but my answer is, yes, there are people to point to, but they're not the usual people. Instead of pointing to Columbus as a hero, let's point to Bartolomé de las Casas, the priest who exposed Columbus's crimes. Instead of glorifying Andrew Jackson, let's make a hero of the Cherokee Indians who resisted his attempt, his actually successful attempt to drive them out of their land. Instead of Theodore Roosevelt as a hero, Theodore Roosevelt who loved war and who congratulated an American general who had just committed a massacre in the Philippines, instead of pointing to Theodore Roosevelt as a great man, why not point to Mark Twain, who was vice president of the Anti-Imperialist League, who criticized Theodore Roosevelt, criticized the war in the Philippines. And instead of looking on Woodrow Wilson as a hero, and he's always portrayed that way in history books, as an idealist, a League of Nations, self-determination. No, let's talk about Helen Keller as a hero, or Emma Goldman as a hero. They protested against World War One, and they stood up for the rights of people in other countries who were the victims of Wilson's policies. You know, Wilson sent troops into Haiti and Dominican Republic and bombarded the Mexican coast. No, not the kind of person who should be held up as a hero. So my book presents different kinds of heroes, and people who speak for the rights of working people and speak against war. So it's it's not a lack of figures who can be models for young people.
Well, Howard Zinn is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's going to be in Detroit on November 5th at the Cranbrook Peace Foundation Peace Lecture, and you can go to let me see here. Yes, cranbrookpeace.org, and get all the details. And there's lots of other things going on. Howard Zinn is going to meet with young people between 14 and 25 earlier that day. Howard, you're going to have a busy day. They've got you they've got you working.
Well, that's the way it usually is. Yeah. That's okay.
Well, every once in a while, in fact, I shouldn't say every once in a while, every Columbus Day, I read the first page of your book, A People's History of the United States, and what that chronicles is the Arawak, as I put it, the Arawak people discovering Columbus, and I also add that here was a case of an inferior culture meeting a superior culture, except Columbus was too dumb to realize. He came there as an armed band and with armored men, both physically and psychologically, from a toxic culture in Europe. Talk about ideologized history. So here's mine. But in any event, I read from Columbus's diary where, after being welcomed by these wonderful people that he found here, that he stumbled upon, he says they will make good servants, and how he could conquer them so easily. And it's odd. No one responds. It's almost like they've been embarrassed that I've said something that a lot of people know, but as you said, he's been elevated to this heroic status. It's a little rude of me, and perhaps of Howard Zinn, to point out his foibles.
Well, you know, we need a little more rudeness.
I agree.
It's, you know, like people who stand up at a gathering of Republicans and say, that's not true. People who stand up and, you know, at a gathering and, you know, where Bush is speaking or where Rumsfeld is speaking, and they hold up a sign saying, stop the war. That's very rude, but necessary. That is the best of the American tradition, dissent, protest, disobedience, the kind of rudeness that Thoreau presented, and that the abolitionists presented to the country, and that the people in the 60s who protested against the Vietnam War, we need more today of that kind of rudeness.
Well, the title of your lecture, that's where I got the phrase lecture from. It's here in the Cranbrook Peace Foundation literature. But your talk is called History as a Guide to Action. Do you mean that in the sense that we can look back at our history and just in the manner you just described and see that, gee, ordinary people just like us changed everything?
I think that's the point. I think that's the idea, that if you read the history of people's struggles and realize that people have, by their unity, by their persistence, by their resistance to authority, managed to achieve certain things in history. Not enough, never enough, but managed to, you know, get the eight-hour day by going on strike, and manage to help stop the Vietnam War by refusing to go into the military, or by soldiers coming back and protesting against the war. Yeah, I think if people learn that history and learn the history of those struggles, it empowers them to become part of the social struggle of our time.
Now, Howard, in your book, A People's History of the United States, was first published in 1980, so they were talking about 26 years more, and there's been numerous editions. I've got about three or four of them. How frequently do you update it? Here we are right in the midst of something today. I mean, I assume you're not going to go out and write a page to talk about this Military Commissions Act, for instance.
No, I'd like to, but... But I do write columns. I can't update the book. The last time the book was updated was right after Bush was elected in 2000, and right after he declared a war on terrorism. So in the latest edition, I have a chapter called "The Election of 2000 and the War on Terrorism." That is, I put "war on terrorism" in quotation marks because I don't believe in it. I don't believe that there's such a thing as a war on terrorism, because war itself is terrorism. But, you know, sure, all these things have happened since 2000, and I can't update the book every week, but I do write articles for the Progressive magazine, you know, which comes out of Madison, Wisconsin, and in which I comment on what's going on now. And in fact, a bunch of those articles for the Progressive are going to be reprinted in a book that will be coming out in December from City Lights Press in San Francisco, a book called A Power Governments Cannot Suppress. So that will be, in a certain way, a sort of an update of my people's history.
Yeah, and also, you can go to Howard Zinn, Z-I-N-N, howardzinn.org. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with you. I'm extraordinarily sad I'm not going to be able to attend the Cranbrook Peace Foundation's 19th Annual Peace Lecture and Award. It's going to be honoring our guest here on the Peter Werbe Show, Howard Zinn. The talk is called History as a Guide to Action. It's going to be in the Riverview Ballroom of Cobo Hall. Other events before that as well, including a way that you can host a Howard Zinn house party. Don't worry, Howard, you don't have to be there for those. They're going to be showing this incredible video documentary of your life. You can't be neutral on a moving train. And you can go to cranbrookpeace.org and find out about all the information. As usual, Howard Zinn, a pleasure being with you.
Thank you, Peter. I always enjoy being with you.
This is WRIM.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I think most of you know of the man, Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary, he was the guru of LSD, the apostle of psychedelia. Richard Nixon called him the most dangerous man in America. And what a life this guy lived. And there's a brand new biography of him. It's written by John Higgs. And John Higgs has written for British publications, including The Guardian, Mojo, and The Independent. And he's created the long-running quiz show X Marks the Spot for BBC Radio 4. He's worked extensively in children's television and animation. He's produced a number of best-selling video games. He lives in Brighton, England. We're talking to him in England right now from Detroit. John Higgs, welcome to the Motor City.
Hi, Peter. Good to speak to you.
Well, thank you so much. Your book is I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. For those few people, or I don't know, maybe we can't count since we have listeners, tell us maybe a little thumbnail sketch of what Timothy Leary is best known for. Of course, your book takes his whole life into consideration, but maybe his most popular media manifestation. What would that look like?
Oh, sure. You know, and certainly in the early 60s, Timothy Leary was a very well-respected psychologist studying at Harvard. And he was researching issues such as behavior change and very well-respected for his books and things like that. Then he discovered or was introduced to psychedelic drugs, LSD, became convinced that this was the magic key that would create meaningful character change in people, and made it his life's ambition to persuade as many people as possible to take such drugs. I think we all know what happened next. The phrase tune in, turn on, drop out entered the national sort of lexicon. The hippies movement appeared, music changed forever, and things were never quite the same again.
Right, and Moody Blues had a song about him, incorrectly saying Timothy Leary is dead. No, what is it? What's the line in there? Timothy Leary is dead.
Timothy Leary's dead. Oh, no, he's outside looking in.
Oh, that's right.
But when he died, they re-recorded it so it sings Timothy Leary lives.
And Timothy Leary lived from 1920 to just a little while ago, right?
Yeah, he died 10 years ago. The book was aimed to come out on the 10th anniversary of his death. It's always a good time to reevaluate people around that time. I always think it's just long enough has gone past to be able to sort of get a clear glimpse at the impact it had on life and things.
Well, John Higgs, there's been other biographies of Timothy Leary, yet you discovered some new documents. Tell us the story about that. It's a pretty interesting story in itself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was writing for Mojo magazine. I don't know if you get that over here. It's an English classic rock magazine about an album Timothy Leary made with the German krautrock band Astral Temple when he was on the run and hiding in Switzerland. And I was there was an English painter and author called Brian Barrett who was very close to Leary at the time. And I was interviewing him about what had happened. And he just sort of scratched his head and goes, you know, I think I've got some of Tim's things somewhere. And he lives in a council flat in South London, and he just goes over to an old chest of drawers and rifled through it and came out with a few boxes of all Timothy Leary's diaries and letters. And of course, what had happened was Leary was captured in Afghanistan. And brought back to America.
He was a fugitive from, he had escaped from prison. We maybe can talk about that a little while later. So he was captured in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So he left lots of things behind him for his 2 years on the run around the world. This guy, Brian, had the forethought to sort of gather them up for posterity. They'd just been sitting and looked at for about 30 years. So it was a real piece of history, a real find. And then when I realized I wanted to write the book, I got in touch with his archivist, Michael Horowitz, and also the estate, and they had masses and masses of material. So I was able to go back to the original sources and find out exactly what happened, because there are many, many inaccurate tales told about Leary, most of them told by himself, I think it's fair to say.
Well, you've told that sort of matter-of-factly, but it must have been an extraordinary experience to hear as this amazing cultural figure from the 20th century that some people say defined the 1960s, in at least its cultural aspect, and there you are holding material that has never been published before. Did you get that sense that you had...
I got a real shock, because I had one of his diaries in my hand, and it was just a small diary with 1972 written on the front, and I just opened it up, and the first thing I read, I probably can't say the word, I just realized it was 2 weeks, 2 trips, 2 great, a sexual word I probably can't say on your radio show, and it was this sort of level of camping sort of material. It's a little snapshot straight into this life, and because the life was so unbelievable, so... all this stuff about him escaping to jail and going on the run to Algiers in Africa and then being kidnapped by the Black Panthers and having to escape from them and then escaping into Europe and then being falling under the clutches of, an exiled French arms dealer. It so looks like the pages of a James Bond novel or something. So, unbelievable. It's incredible to think that, a life is lived at that sort of level just 30 years ago.
Well, I think you may have whetted a lot of appetites. This is the whole story. We're talking with John Higgs. He's in Brighton, England, as we speak with him. He's written the book, I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. You can go to ihaveamericasurrounded.com, right? Am I the right suffix?
That's the one.
ihaveamericasurrounded.com. It's published by Barricade Books. So some of these stories have certainly been told, but there are ones that, I was talking with somebody about it, and a lot of the life of Timothy Leary was kind of foggy. Now he and the man that became Ram Dass, they set up this little kind of psychedelic house, and their adversary was, who is now a right-wing talk show host, G. Gordon Liddy. Tell us that little bit of it.
In many ways, Leary was responsible for Liddy getting to the White House and Watergate and everything that happened because of that. He was, I can't remember the exact rank, but he worked for the local county police, and they just wanted Leary out of, this is Millbrook, in New York State, and they just wanted all these guys, they were academics and researchers, but they were clearly a strange bunch in this big old estate, running strange experiments with having strange visitors. And so they raided the house in the middle of, I suppose you would call it a harassment nowadays. Everyone going into the house is stopped and searched, and people are ticketed for the most minor details, and for the person who owned the house had to set it up as an office and had to sort of a victim. And this gave Liddy the reputation as a drugs expert in law enforcement departments, and he quickly moved the ranks and made it all to the White House and to the career he has now.
Now, why, I was looking at some of the other people that assessed him. The writer Hunter S. Thompson, on the back of your book, he says, Tim was a chieftain. He stomped on the terror and he left his elegant hoofprints on all our lives. But he also said Timothy Leary was not just wrong, but a treacherous creep and a horrible goddamn person. What?
Absolutely. And in fact, it was that quote from Hunter S. Thompson that really made me want to write the book, because that was when there was a lot of information released about Timothy's collaboration with the FBI when he was in jail, back in jail in the early 70s. And this was information that was known at the time, but it sort of reappeared in the late 90s and was presented as shocking news that this counterculture figure was, speaking to the FBI. And the whole context of the story had been lost, the whole, the details and the intricacies. And I figured if Hunter S. Thompson is judging him so strongly on this one thing, that it was probably a good time to try and sort of put the context back on Leary's life and sort of blow away a lot of the baggage and the misunderstandings and just try to present it sort of quite cleanly.
Well maybe I was going to say, maybe we should examine his legal problems. Now, LSD was legal up until, October 6, 1966, So then it became an illegal drug. And how did Leary relate to the prohibition of the key element of his turn on, tune in, drop out philosophy?
Yeah, up until LSD becoming illegal, people often forget that Leary was publicly, at least, almost respectable or understandable about how he talked about the drug. He advocated responsible use with guides, and he advocated something called set and setting, which sort of prevents bad trips, and was talking about it being the drug being legal and taxed, and being a proper system for Americans to be able to take the drug. But it's only when it was made illegal that he really it sort of raised the ante for him. He started taking his message directly to the youth of America, to the hippie movement that was just burgeoning around then. As soon as all of the avenues had been closed to him, he basically just went completely public. Up in, media-friendly sound bites, he could find, was appearing to all the right happenings and parties and gigs and things, and just telling everybody that they should take this very, very powerful psychedelic drug. The figures are very good. A common one is 8 million Americans did so because of his advocacy.
Now, John Higgs, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish up.
Oh, no, sorry, Peter.
Okay. We're talking to John Higgs, and John Higgs, among other publications, has written for the rock magazine Mojo. And I suspect by looking at your photograph that you were present and during the height of the rave movement in England. And many people say that ecstasy that fueled a lot of the raves, altered the character of English youth, almost a generation. I don't know how broad one can take that, but can you compare the impact of LSD in the 1960s and the impact of ecstasy in the 1980s and the 1990s, one in the U.S., one in England?
Oh, I mean, that's a difficult question. It certainly was a similar sort of size of impact. I mean, obviously, the thing in the 60s was the first of its kind, I guess. So there was a lot of lessons being learned as we went along. The ecstasy thing, unfortunately, at the time, I was very much into grunge, which I kind of regret now. I think I made the wrong musical choices about 15 years ago. So I missed a lot of the rave scene myself. But it's certainly the... It's interesting because the rave scene became a very political thing over here, because there was a piece of legislation called the Criminal Justice Bill that was designed to basically crush it out, because it arose spontaneously and quite illegally on the outskirts of London. Huge parties with 5, 10, up to 20, I think it was a 50,000 person illegal rave just appearing spontaneously. No stars, no heroes, no, there's just a few anonymous DJs. It's just a total communal, almost like a tribal thing. It's just a completely different way of living, and people saw it as a thing that was just so good and rewarding compared to the normal 9-to-5 rat race and the normal jobs like that. But yes, it became crushed, and I think it's not too strong a word, by a piece of legislation called the Criminal Justice Bill, which made it illegal for I think it was 10 people to gather and listen to music with repetitive beats or something like that. and so that politicized a lot of the counterculture over here to an extent that led to a lot of the anti-globalization movement over here. It's all very much tied into that. The psychedelics in the 60s was a lot more, how would you describe it? It was just a break from everything that had gone before. A lot of people I spoke to said that the 1950s were in black and white. They were in black and white. That's how they saw them. And life changed so hugely for a lot of these people involved in the psychedelic scene at the time. It almost became a different world, but the rave thing was very much about a better world. So I guess the differences are something like that.
Well, I know the legendary surrounding of the Pentagon in 1967, and I can't remember whether it was Leary at that, where people actually did take LSD, and they said they were going to levitate the Pentagon. I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that was Abbie Hoffman.
Yeah, it was Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies, but I don't know.
Yes,
go ahead.
Very much. That was always the thing that sort of turned me off the 60s and the hippies as growing up. So I heard that story quite early, and it just struck me as so naive that all these people tried to levitate the Pentagon. It's such a ludicrous thing that they could actually believe in.
Oh, ye of little faith!
But since I've learned more about it, I understand the sort of the humor of the thing and how it was just part of a larger sort of movement and things like that. So now I find it very funny, I have to say.
Well, John Higgs, it was my fault, but I kind of interrupted the story of Leary's legal problem. So LSD is made illegal in 1966, yet the drug bust that tripped Leary up and led him to essentially becoming an informant for the FBI and other law enforcement groups wasn't LSD, as you relate in your book, I Have America Surrounded, the life of Timothy Leary, but marijuana. So maybe pick it up from there.
Yeah, and a very small amount of marijuana as well. He had two busts, with both finding a few flakes or a couple of roaches in a car that didn't belong to him that he happened to be in. And because of that, he was sentenced to up to 20 years, which for a man who was 50 years old is a life sentence in all but name. There's no doubt it was a political thing. There's no doubt that the Nixon government wanted Leary off the streets, and they wanted to lock him up. And they knew that a lot of the sort of mainstream America wanted that as well. Nixon was the extent of calling Leary the most dangerous man in America, which is where the title of my book comes from. In one of his last interviews, he was asked about this, and he just deadpanned in this. In this perfectly serious voice, yes, I have America surrounded, which struck me as so funny.
Sure.
It's the classic Leary gag that I had to use it as the title. He was his wife and his son and in one arrest and his daughter in another bust. They were also charged with possession of marijuana. And so he kind of had to plead guilty to get them off him. It was made very clear to him that it was him he was after. And in 1970, he was sent to jail.
And there he was in Northern California, right? But in one of America's most famous jailbreaks, to pick it up there, if you would.
Well, I mean, it's so funny. When he was jailed, he went for the mandatory psychological tests, which all prisoners go through, where they decide where they're going to send the prisoner. And for as many years as Leary had to serve, 20 years, he would normally be sent to a high-security prison because long sentence equals escape risk. But he was given these tests. And he looked at them, and he realized that he'd invented most of them in about 14 years earlier, in the 1950s, when he was one of the most respected behavioral psychologists in America. So he knew what every question was testing, what every answer would reveal. So he filled out the forms in such a way that would make him look the most docile and meek individual it was possible to appear. And so when the decision to which prison to send him to was made, these forms said that Timothy Leary was in no way an escape risk, despite what anybody who had read the papers over the previous decade might have thought. And so he was sent to a low-security prison in San Luis Obispo. And a few months later, he was over the wire. He climbed onto the top of the cell block and got across the wire on a telephone pole. And the weather underground got him out of America, and 2 weeks later he surfaced in Algiers with the Black Panthers.
Now, so this is this incredible situation. Timothy Leary is in jail. The weather underground breaks him out. There's this, somehow they're able to get him to Algiers, where Eldridge Cleaver, the fugitive Black Panther, is. This is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the great hope was that he was seen as the leader of the white counterculture, and Cleaver was seen as the leader of the black counterculture, and there's a lot of hope that Cleaver and Leary would work together and sort of unite the movement and so forth.
But he ran afoul of Cleaver.
He was, right, Peter?
That what?
I didn't catch
it. Oh, I'm sorry. He ran afoul of Eldridge Cleaver, and there was a break there, right?
Yeah, I mean, Cleaver and Lee had absolutely nothing in common. It's probably the easiest way to look at it. And it also became a bit... sort of looking after Leary was a lot of heat, a lot of pressure for Cleaver when there was all sorts of the Black Panther Party in particular was there was a lot of the CIA's I can't remember the name of the program COINTELPRO the COINTELPRO were really working on the Black Panther Party, trying to sort of create divisions and force splits and things, and let the party sort of turn on itself and attack itself, which was working very, very successfully. And so the last thing that Cleaver needed was someone like Timothy Leary, with all the the worst wanted man in America, with all the attention he was getting on his patch. And he kidnapped him. He kidnapped him and his wife, Rosemary, and they were taken out of their out of their apartment building and driven and locked up in safe houses for the best part of a week with no idea if anybody knew they'd been kidnapped or whether there was any attempt to save them or anything like that. Much, much scarier than being in the jails in America, where obviously, due legal process and things like this. They had no idea at all what was going to happen. They managed to get out of that by getting, they were sort of allowed to release, but they had to give them their passports, which they managed to trick another panther to get their passports back, which led them to sort of flee Algeria.
Well, let me do this. We're quickly running out of time. This is an extraordinary story, and it's well chronicled in John Higgs's book, I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. But let me bring this part to a conclusion by saying that Leary winds up in Switzerland. He is finally apprehended by the American authorities in Afghanistan. He's brought back to the United States. He's facing, as we said earlier, 20 years in jail. And then he begins, in the parlance at the time, narking, ratting out his old pals, right, as a way to gain favor.
Yeah, well, I say absolutely. It's not a very black and white situation. I mean, he certainly was talking to the FBI, and he certainly was trying to cooperate with them to the extent that would get him released earlier. But, I mean, it's well known that he spent 2 years talking to them, and, no one was jailed or arrested for anything he said. The main reason being because he didn't know a lot of the things that they thought he knew. They wanted to... they wanted to bust the Hood of Eternal Love, which was a big drugs gang, and they wanted to get the weather underground. And Leary had been on the run for the past 2 years, and a little bit out of the loop, of course.
All right, let's do this. I was just going to say, I mean, just looking at this clock, and this story is so fantastic, that's why you have to go get the book, I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. But just a couple things in here. Finally, he is pardoned in 1976 by Governor Jerry Brown, and reinvents himself again, lives another 20 years. When he dies, his body is cremated, and their ashes are sent around the world, and you, John Higgs, they sent you some ashes. What was the occasion of that?
Oh, that was such a shock. I have to, the woman who runs the archive was a lovely, lovely woman called Dennis Berry, who helped me out so much, who went to the States, sorry. And I'd spent about 10 days or so in what's essentially a big lock-up in the Santa Cruz mountains, where all his life's possessions are stored, going to all his papers. And on the very last day, when I was given the keys and things back, she goes, "Oh, did you look in this one box?" And there were about 300 boxes in this place, and that one that I'd missed. And I don't know what's in there. And she goes, "Oh, Tim's in there."
Oh, wow.
And she pulls out this cigar box with the remains of the ashes in there. A very small pinch, as you say, had gone into space, and little pinches had got to many, many of his friends. But she was so kind enough to send me one. And we scattered it here in England on Glastonbury tour. And on the night we were doing that, I met people who said, "Oh, yes, I was in Mexico." And I met some guys from MAPS, which is a psychedelic study organization. And they were burying a portion of Leary's ashes under a pyramid.
Well, I think that the most... interesting part of it, a small amount was shot into orbit along with the remains of Star Trek's Gene Roddenberry. You know, there's so much more here. I wanted to ask you the story about Winona Ryder, who wrote the foreword to this. No time for that. The only way to do it, get this incredible book, wonderful photographs as well. I have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary. It's published by Barricade, and the website is ihaveamericasurrounded.com. And John Higgs, thanks so much for joining us from Brighton, England. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, pleasure was all mine, Peter.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable. Deemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Jay Hudson.
Jay Hudson.
There is none higher.
Jay Hudson.
Straight out of Detroit, baby.
Hell yeah, man.
Hey!
Score, score, score!
Oh, that sounds so sweet.
Jay Hudson, I love you.
Hey, you think KFC's still open?
I'm calling the shots! Consider me f***ing...
Jay Hudson.
This is my f***ing chocolate factory. You got it?
I'm not going to be able to do that. I'm not going to be able to do that.